Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Alongside me this week is Northern pop star and arts editor Lucy Dallas. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
Lucy, did you know a very fine poet was in an email communication with Thea last week praising the podcast but complaining that he, that's me, mentions cheese too much?
Did I know that?
Yes.
I might have heard it around the office.
Yes, I was going to make a cheese joke.
Go on. Oh no, you've got to make the cheese joke.
Apparently she camembert it.
Yay.
So this show will now be entirely free of cheese from now on. But where is Thea? Well, she is, in heavily inverted commas, working from home this week, which is to say playing with her new dog, Alf, but she's on the line to give us a canine update. Thea, hello.
Hello, hello. Let me just brush those air quotes out of the way.
Yeah. Have you been working hard?
I have. I've been reading all sorts in between taking Alf out.
You've been sending sporadic emails, I've noticed, at the sort of the beginning and the end of the day.
Just to create the illusion.
Very, very wise. One right at the beginning of the day and then one really late.
Oddly early, I thought. Oddly earlier than oddly late is the way to do it.
That's because I'm waking up very early.
Oh, is it bad?
I mean, bless him. He arrived on Friday night at midnight, completely discombobulated and a bit of a wreck. And he was kind of zonked the first night, so we were lured into a false sense of security, but... he's kind of becoming a bit more confident and possibly obsessed with me.
Oh. You don't want him to be like not bothered.
I quite like that. If you just went, oh, Thea.
He cries at night, so we have to be really, really firm, which is so hard.
Oh, does he cry when you're not there?
Yeah,
that's what we're all doing.
Why don't you just let him sleep in your room? Is that not
good thinking, Roz? Yeah, I agree with Roz. Why aren't you doing that, Thea?
Because he's absolutely enormous.
He is massive. Oh, right. I've seen a picture. I mean, he's a big dog.
22.5 kilos. Whoa. And he's only seven months
that's
old.
A quarter of me.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah.
He looks like he's just slinked straight out of Little Red Riding Hood. He is like an archetypal fairy tale wolf.
Brilliant. Oh, well, the best to keep the wolf on your side, I think.
Yeah. Thea, are you back next week?
I am. I'm back on Monday.
Lovely. We'll hear from you. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye. There we go.
I'm very jealous.
I had a pair with Biscuit waking up in the night. And I used to go and sleep downstairs on the sofa with him so he wouldn't bark loud enough to wake the baby. So the baby was getting up twice a night, and then Biscuit started getting up and I was sleeping on a sofa with a dog.
Yeah.
And then we worked through it. We, you know, you have to put him back in this little crate. And anyway, this is a literary podcast. This is not... God's sake.
You started.
Yeah, I did. Coming up on the show this week, Rosalind Deneen is in the studio, our features editor and audio correspondent, who'll be telling us about good stuff-ish in the world of podcasts. Well, actually, not. You're pretty down on podcasts this week.
Well, not all of them.
All right, we'll get to that. And Toby Lichtig, fiction editor and editor of Jewish Studies, is here too, despite still unbelievably being on paternity leave. Which has been something going on forever.
You're supposed to be supportive about that.
It's gone on for
that,
literally months.
Especially in public.
Thanks to my very supportive editor. I have been on paternity leave, so there you go.
And you're going to talk through our special issue on Jewish studies.
Yes, I am.
Lovely. Remember, you should be subscribing to the TLS. Google subscriptions now and join our happy band. Franz Kafka's literary estate has always been at the centre of controversy. Kafka famously gave instructions to his friend Max Brod to burn all of his papers without reading them. Brod famously ignored him and saw into print all sorts of material that would have been scandalously destroyed. This week, Gabriel Giuseppevici investigates what happened to the estate when Brod died and asks the question, was Kafka primarily a German or a Jewish author? He was, of course, a Czech author. It's another way of looking at it. It begins our section on Jewish studies, which also takes in the question of Jewishness and race, the related savage violence of the 20th century, and then the question of returns of Jewish people to Belarus and Palestinians to their homeland. So there's plenty to talk about with our editor, Toby Lichtig. Toby, hello.
Hello.
Kafka.
Yes.
You didn't commission this piece. I recognise that. But
I've read my Kafka.
I was interested in the question, actually. I'd not thought of this before. Is he a Jewish author? Is he seen...
It depends who's answering that question. I mean, I think to Kafka himself, the idea of him being an anything author, you know, allegiance to any group, whether it's Jewishness or Czechness or Germanness. I mean, he famously said, what have I in common with Jews? I have little enough in common with myself. He is an author of...
That's a great line.
It's a good line. He's an author of radical alienation.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, yes, you could make arguments that a lot of his writing is informed by his Jewishness and that sense of alienation.
And maybe Yiddish kind of folklore, do you think, sort of crops into that?
To a certain extent, yes. But in terms of, you know, ownership, it all depends on who's claiming. And so, you know, if you're a library in Germany, then you might want his papers and you might claim he's German. Obviously, the Israel National Library is fairly convinced that he's a Jewish author and they want his stuff because
of that's what's happened, hasn't it?
Exactly.
So Max Brod died. He gives it. Max Brod inherits a lot of Kafka's.
He inherits a lot of Kafka's. You know, as you say, he's supposed to destroy it. He doesn't. He reads it. He thinks it's brilliant. He gets it out there, and we can be very grateful to him for that. And then a tremendously convoluted story follows. So Brod ends up leaving Central Europe and going to Israel as a result of the Holocaust. He then befriends this woman, Esther Hoffer, who becomes his secretary stroke lover, leaves a very confusing will, two wills, in fact, one of which is incredibly vague about whether this literary material, this estate, should be dispersed to the Israel National Archives, or whether it actually is Hoffer's to, you know, make use of as she wants to, i.e. to sell off in chunks to finance her life. She then clings on to it. There are various legal challenges by the Israeli state, essentially, through the guise of the National Library. She then has a sort of temerity to live to the age of 101. So this goes on for a long time. And there's a ruling at some point which says that they are her materials until her death, but she can't pass them on.
And then it becomes the property of the Israeli...
Yes, except this was also contested. So she dies at age 101 in, I think, 2007, and bequeaths the papers to her two daughters, who were still alive at the time. One then dies, one carries on the battle for another decade. It's crazy, isn't it? And then she eventually loses in 2016, and the bulk of the papers, there were bits and pieces that were sold. I think a couple of original manuscripts. I think the manuscript for the trial had already been sold on. But in the end, in 2016, the Israeli National Library managed to acquire the rest of the material.
How tempted are we to describe this whole situation as Kafkaesque? You're not going to, Lucy.
I thought our critic, Gabriel Giuseppevici, did a very good thing. It's a very, very good piece. And he doesn't even pretend, he doesn't go down the route of Kafka, he just says in a kind of fairly sort of offhand way, it's Shandian, as in, you know, Tristram Shandy, yeah. Which I thought was a very, very good way of doing it. He says it's Shandian and it's chaos and confusion.
But it is weird that this guy who was Czech... And the Czech state is conspicuously absent in this row. It seems to me that I suppose so, but Prague, don't you? I mean,
yeah,
he's a Prague writer.
You do, but he is a Prague writer. But I mean, I guess, you know, he wrote in German. I don't think he particularly identified as a Czech person.
Yeah.
The German claim on him, I find a bit mystifying. He wrote in German, but that's what people were doing within Czechoslovakia at the time. That was more of a sort of seen as a literary language, a bit like Russians who used to write in French.
But also Czechoslovakia, I mean, he died in, I think, was it 1924, and Czechoslovakia had only been a state for about 6 years. So the idea of Czechness at that stage, no, he
sure,
wasn't, but he was Germanic.
But he wasn't Israeli. I mean, it's a weird thing.
No, God, no, and absolutely, he sort of abhorred Zionism. So the idea that you know, Israel was going to
Really?
He was no Zionist. I mean, I think he said contradictory things, and he was quite contradictory. But yeah, I mean, in the same way that, you know, any of those sort of nationalist causes were anathema to him. Yeah, the idea that Israel would claim him as one of his own is bizarre as well.
It just seems to me like that thing where we go, oh, English literature, Joyce, Wilde, and this is not English literature. I mean, you can co-opt if it's in the same language, but these are people from a different place. And if you are going to be nationalistic about it, which I think is a fairly ridiculous thing to do anyway,
it's got to go somewhere,
an argument for not doing it.
Yeah, and
yes,
yeah,
but then why doesn't it go to Boulder or the University of Cardiff?
An argument that Israel has put forward, you know, not wrongly, is wait a sec, the Germans were the one that destroyed his family and you know tried to kill Brodden. So you know, why do they get the claim just because he wrote in that language?
The German claim on it seems, I mean,
the weakest, arguably the weakest one, that is based on language rather than anything else.
Yeah,
and Brod is in Israel because of the Holocaust.
Exactly, precisely because of that.
So you could say that they gave him, you know, they took him in.
Yeah,
I mean they did take him in.
Yeah, they did.
As someone who's read this piece.
Have you not
as
read this piece?
As another person who's read this piece, I think you mean.
On behalf of the listeners, who might not have read it.
Well done, yes, Ros. Well done. You play that role. Yeah, that's decent of you.
What happened to them? Where did they go?
The papers.
Yeah.
Israel National. So the National Library now has
Israel wins.
Israel wins.
As of 2016, Israel wins. And not the entire estate is not intact, because Hoffa did sell off little bits and pieces during her lifetime. But most of it is now.
I mean, it is one of the great acts of literary salvage, isn't it? The Brod ignoring.
Oh, God, or betrayal. Yeah, absolutely.
Or betrayal.
Since he specifically asked him to burn them all.
Yeah, but that's interesting. I regard it as an act of saving a person from himself. So we get the trial, the castle, and America.
Exactly.
The novel. I mean, the Stoker had appeared as a short story, the beginning of America, but everything else was we would never have had.
Yeah.
It's like Nabokov asked for his final novel, The Original of Laura, to be burnt, and it was ignored.
Mm.
And I remember reviewing it for the TLS, and it's not especially good.
But we're glad it exists.
It's interesting, and you see, and it's been preserved in these amazing handwritten index cards. And you see little flourishes of Nabokov, and it's kind of, you see little nods back to Lolita. The central character is very Lolita-like. There is a baddie who's Humbert-like, and you get little moments of Nabokov.
Absolutely, and without Brod, Kafka would have. He'd have been almost unknown. He'd have been
really,
a very
even though Metamorphosis existed.
Well, yeah. Yes, I'm sure it would have been rediscovered, but he would have still have been a fairly minor writer. I mean, even with all the posthumous stuff, there's not actually that much. He didn't publish. He didn't write an enormous amount. He died aged 41. He wasn't enormously prolific. You know, he had a full-time day job.
And why? And why has he? Because actually, it's an interesting question, that, isn't it? That Kafka is one of the few authors who get an adjective.
Yep.
That's become. There's Orwell. There's Shakespeare.
I'm not sure I've met anyone who dislikes his writing. I mean, you know, he's one of those.
Dickensian, maybe, yeah.
Dickensian. He's one of those great, with a capital G, authors of the 20th century.
But is it
seems to he seems to.
But is he
liked.
Respected more? Is he respected more than loved? Because whenever I've read Kafka,
I kind
of feel that you're in the presence of a shimmering genius. And once you read Metamorphosis, and God knows what it's like in the German, but when you read it in an English translation, it feels like this extraordinary first time anyone has done a story like that. It feels like it's being sort of considered fresh each time. But do you turn to Kafka for pleasure?
It
just feels like
how you get your pleasures. I mean,
yeah.
I like stories.
I like stories about people becoming
beetles.
Insects. Yeah.
I feel that he's so singular and brilliant this very day, and that what he has to say still seems.
It's because he's so weird, isn't it? That, like, if you read The Trial, it is so. Strikingly, bafflingly odd and just pitched slightly askew that it lingers in the mind. I mean, he's responsible for a lot of bad imitation, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he arguably ruined Kurt Seer. Because,
you can't hold that against people. So it's Proust and Joyce and all those people responsible for a lot of, and Beckett, a lot of terrible imitations.
Well, yeah, but it's striking that a lot of those, you again, are great with a capital G, but I don't know how many. I mean, no one reads Beckett novels for pleasure.
But it depends what you mean by pleasure. You might not read it for relaxation, but you might read it because it's a wonderful, kind of amazing, weird.
I mean, I've read the trilogy. Have you read the trilogy?
I have read the trilogy. I read it during university, and I did find pleasure. I found it incredibly stimulating. Have I turned to it again in recent years? No. Would I recommend it? Yes, it's fascinating.
Kafka
I reread, though. I mean, I have actually reread Kafka. I don't think I will reread the trilogy in the next...
No, I just think when I read bad Coetzee, which is a large chunk of Coetzee, there's a kind of that sort of self-conscious strangeness that... Because he wrote The Life and Times of Joseph K, didn't he? Is that Coetzee? Something Joseph K? It's an early one.
Yes,
I think so. Anyway, there's an influence.
Don't blame the imitators. Yeah. I think he was the original.
Yeah, it's fine. He did it well. We need to keep going because there's a large chunk of this, Toby, which you have helmed into the paper despite not being here ever.
I will be soon.
Will be soon. R.I. Moore.
Yes,
it's two books on the Middle Ages, and we're none of us historians, but I am struck by there was a famous pogrom in the sort of medieval period, pogroms against the Jews. They were expelled in the 13th century.
They were expelled in the 13th century.
We never really seem to bear the shame of that, do we?
Not really, no. I certainly wasn't really taught about Jewish persecution in this country at school. I think a few of us know that Oliver Cromwell welcomed back the Jews, and I'm saying that in inverted commas because that's actually a complex thing and he didn't really welcome them back with open arms. But very few people actually... know that they were sort of expelled in the first place, and who it was,
and some of them were killed, weren't they? It wasn't just expelled because the whole blood libel thing came to this country.
There's an argument that medieval blood libel started in this country. It started in Norwich in the 12th century, and a lot of the persecution tied in with the Crusades, so lots of anti-Jewish sentiment during the Crusades, and also extortion. So Crusades were financed by it was a small Jewish population. We're only talking about 3,000 or 4,000 people, but there was a lot of extortion. And yes, I don't really think it's talked about.
One of the other books is saying that this sort of creation of race and identity was created around the same time, around the time of the Crusades.
Absolutely.
Because the Crusades were incredibly influential and also sort of dividing people up.
And defining another, though, is a...
Defining another,
exactly, so you go, you're Jews, or rather they're all Saracens.
They're all Saracens, yes, exactly. All Muslims are Saracens, even though there are Berbers, there are, Muslims in what's now Turkey, completely different
and
sorts
they weren't
of
defined
cultures.
Like that before yeah, but exactly. Then so it's kind of it was the Christians against the pagans, which were the Jews, the Saracens, and they started dividing people up also by colour. I think that isn't that what the book is saying,
exactly. And the argument that it's no surprise really it's exactly at this time that persecution of the Jews really steps up, and I think there's a line, England led the way.
Oh, God.
Another proud moment of our history. Which is interesting because history in our schools, maybe it's overcompensated for now, I don't know. But
not Plaskov.
There's large chunks, isn't there, of... I never learned about the Indian Mutiny until I read a Flashman book. I didn't know anything about the Boer War concentration camps until I read something when I was 30, 25. The expulsion of the Jews, I think I read about in a historical novel.
Yeah.
There's a whole chunks of... The formation of the British state and then the empire that you don't really, because you do Tudors
you
and then you kind of do the
now,
first
though. And second. You get a bit of it now.
You get a bit of
20th
century
now.
Imperial shame and 19th century imperial shame. Yeah. Not enough, in my opinion. But yeah,
really?
You're right about earlier in history.
You don't think that's enough now?
No, not really. I mean, I don't know. I haven't actually been to school for a while, but from what I gather.
We'll see with our kids, won't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether they ever get. Because it's still they're all like, oh, your kids are older. What have they done?
They do hear, that's what I'm saying about the other side of empire, as it were. It's not at all glorious.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was even glory when I was. It just wasn't really done. It was you do Tudors and you do First and Second World War.
No, they're doing much more.
And you did the
now.
Industrial Revolution, but that was all about children in mines. It wasn't about then leading to colonialism.
They've learned a bit about what happened to the Indians. I think under the empire, it's not, as I say, it's not just that we came in and wasn't England wonderful, and they learn much more about slavery and abolition of slavery. Yeah. They're much more clued up about that. The earlier stuff, I think not. I haven't, they do a bit of Cromwell because they always do Cromwell because that's a good, that's a kind of, there's a lot to get your teeth into around there. I don't think they've done sort of the Crusades. At all?
No, you get actually. a bit of conqueror and all the rest of it.
But. I do that.
That's
level.
About yeah.
I
that's
that
yeah.
But this question of historiography is interesting because it comes out in this really throughout the issue, Toby, which is the idea of the lachrymose view of Jewish history.
Yes.
It's a historian called Salo Whitmayer Baron has coined the term, I think, potentially.
Yeah.
And his family was murdered in the Holocaust.
Yeah. So he first used. The term, I believe, in this is this influential paper once he'd come to New York in the 20s. So this was well before the Holocaust. but obviously there'd been an ignoble history of persecution to draw on then. And his point was, too much in Jewish history and historiography is made of persecution. Actually, it was about what was happening between the pogroms that's of the most interest. I think there's a line, you know, Jews were thinking, writing, selling, buying, building. You know, they weren't always being beaten up.
And it's a fair point, isn't it?
And it's a fair point. Mm. And then the Holocaust happened and his whole family were killed. And he sort of stuck by his guns to a kind of quite admirable extent and said, well, yes, you know, this happened. However, it's a long history. And in the sense that
let's not only be defined by
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think he didn't use this phrase, but it's essentially the cult of victimhood. He, you know, he didn't like the idea that Judaism was all about a cult of victimhood.
But we do it. I mean, Michael Stanislavski's written a really great piece on five different books with the word pogrom in the title.
Yeah.
Or four books. A lot of them. And we do it all the time. We do Second World War. You know, how much of Second World War studies then goes to the Holocaust? And legitimately so, because you don't want to forget.
It's about balance, isn't it? And there's a funny phrase about all Jewish festivals, you know, dating back 3,000-4,000 years. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. Which I think kind of encapsulates it quite well, both in terms of the humour, but also this is why we're having this festival. I often wonder what will happen to our remembrance of the Holocaust many, many centuries hence, assuming we haven't all been wiped out by climate change, sort of 500, 600, 700 years on, is it going to become another festival in the same way that lots of other Jewish festivals are there to say, hey, we got through it, let's eat? It sounds like a bit of an awkward question to ask now, but it's...
Do you think that might happen?
Well, I don't know. It's interesting to think of, isn't it?
Because, well, the 12th century pogroms are not even thought about at all.
No,
this is a much greater scale. But, I mean,
yeah, much greater
but
scale.
But history does...
I mean, most of the ones, most of the major festivals, you know, Purim is coming up, and I can't remember exactly which siege that was, but that was, you know, it's a tremendously exuberant festival in which particularly members of the Hasidic faith get absolutely hammered, and it's sort of a version of carnival. But actually, it's to commemorate a near slaughter in which a few people got out. Now, I'm not saying that's exactly going to happen to the Holocaust 500 years, 1,000 years hence, but it's interesting to think about how much persecution and the idea of victimhood is bound up in Jewish history. And yeah, I'm sort of with Baron that we definitely shouldn't take the lachrymose view, but at the same time, that idea of survival through oppression is kind of integral to the faith aspect as much
and
as
always has
and always has been, you know, yeah, for
the
for
Bible
millennia.
The first books of the Bible were written in exile in Babylon, weren't they?
Exactly.
There's lots more we can talk about, but I think we're gonna have to move on, Toby. You're going to stick around because you've been writing in the paper despite not being here very much.
Yes,
so we're going to come back to Arthur Miller and you shortly.
Great.
But today's podcast, I need to tell you, is brought to you in association with Harvard University Press. Specifically, a book which is about this. In October 1773, after a grueling trek from Paris, Denis Diderot, Lucy, is that right? Diderot?
Mm.
Yeah, well done. Stumbled from a carriage in St. Petersburg. The century's most subversive thinker, Diderot, arrived as the guest of its most ambitious and admired ruler, Empress Catherine of Russia. What followed was unprecedented, more than 40 private meetings stretching over nearly 4 months between these two extraordinary figures. Diderot had come from Paris in order to guide, or so he thought, the woman who had become the continent's last great hope for an enlightened ruler. But as it soon became clear, Catherine had a very different understanding, not just of her role, but of his as well. Philosophers, she claimed, had the luxury of writing on unfeeling paper. Rulers had the task of writing on human skin, sensitive to the slightest touch. Diderot and Catherine's series of meetings captured the imagination of their contemporaries. And there's a book about it, Catherine and Diderot, The Empress, the Philosopher and the Fate of the Enlightenment, out now and published by Harvard University Press. Robert Zaretsky traces the lives of these two remarkable figures, inviting us to reflect on the fraught relationship between politics and philosophy and between a man of thought and a woman of action. Listeners of this podcast can order a copy of Catherine and Diderot at the special price of £15. That's £5 off, plus postage and packaging, by emailing info@harvardup.co.uk. quoting TLS podcast. That's info@harvardup.co.uk. Lucy, you know all about Diderot.
I know very little about Diderot, but he's good fun.
He's good fun.
He did the encyclopedia and he kind of sort of ushered in the Enlightenment, she said, broadly, didn't he?
Done.
Kinda. Along with this, you must never forget the Scottish people. Scottish people did the Enlightenment and Diderot, yeah. They're all pretty cool.
It sounds to me that you need to read this book though, to fill out some of the knowledge.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Those of you who pay close attention to the TLS, which I'm assuming is absolutely everyone,
including you, Lucy,
including, well, of course, me, will be familiar.
Constantly reading the TLS.
And
Roz, I don't feel Roz reads the TLS very much either.
Can I get even 9 words into my introduction or not?
Make most of it, Lucy. Your colleagues will hear that, and they'll feel completely.
We all make.
We do.
There's not that many of us. There's a lot of it, so yeah. We do. Yeah.
And those of us who do make it up, and everyone else who is very familiar with it, will also be particularly familiar with the audiovisual page.
Indeed.
Which is our monthly roundup of listening and watching. This week, Roz Dineen talks about hearing women's true voices, whether through myth, antiquity, or true crime. Roz, thank you for coming to talk to us. If you can get a word in edgeways, that is.
I cannot stress how much I read the TLS.
Don't rise to it.
I probably
read
it more.
We're not producing it. She's reading it.
Toby, have you been reading it on your paternity?
I have. It's been sent to me every week, and I've read literally most of it.
People worry about not reading all of it. You don't have to read all of it.
You're the one who worries us about us.
Well, no,
not
you need to read all of it. It's your job.
It's not my job to read. Anyway, I don't think we should be doing this on air. So, Roz.
Hi.
You start with, it has to be said, a rather distressing sounding podcast, which is in the line of the true crime kind of category, called The Last Days of August. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So, The Last Days of August is a podcast by John Ronson. So he's become quite famous now. He's a best-selling author. He wrote that book about the psychopath test. He wrote a book about online bullying, and he's done another podcast series, which is called
He's massive, isn't he, really?
He's a really big deal, yeah.
Yep.
He can turn into a film, the psychopath.
Yeah.
Is that the man who stares at goats?
Yes.
George Clooney.
Yes, exactly. And he sort of started by just doing, a couple of years ago on This American Life, doing the odd, really interesting, investigative story. He's done one podcast series before, which was called The Butterfly Effect, which looked at how the porn industry became kind of a big kind of technological industry, basically, the tech takeover of porn. So he did that, and then this new podcast comes out called The Last Days of August, and I think, that's right up my street. John Ronson, brilliant stuff he's done. It's really disturbing. It's about a porn star called August Ames, who committed suicide when she was 23, and it was right after there'd been a sort of Twitter storm. So she did a tweet saying that she wasn't going to do a job, a sex scene, because the person she was going to do it with was a crossover performer, which means that they sometimes are filmed having sex with men and sometimes with women. And she said she didn't want to do that. There was a big, big Twitter pile-on about that. Look, she got so much abuse because everyone said you're being homophobic.
Yeah.
Her husband said she just doesn't want to sleep with people who she thinks might not fancy her, which is...
There's a lot of layers in this story.
There's
already,
a lot of layers, yeah.
We're not going to get to the bottom of
this. We're not going to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah.
Anyway, she killed herself. John Ronson goes along and interviews everyone who's around her, everyone who's in that world.
I mean, it's a kind of investigation, isn't it? And talking to people. But I think in your piece, you seem to think that there are some fundamental questions and assumptions about the porn industry and the way we talk about it, and also the validity of some of the true crime podcasts, and that these things are being a bit unchallenged, they're being kind of accepted. Is that
sure.
right?
Sure. So if you take even if you just take the porn bit out of it for a minute, there are so many true crime podcasts now. There are dozens more every week. There's sort of websites dedicated to how you navigate your true crime listening, and you think, what are people going for here? People love it. What are they there for?
They've always loved it, though.
They've always loved it, exactly. But there's something, no one is really acknowledging the thing that, like, it starts with a dead body.
Yeah.
It's often a woman. Yep. You often go into her sexual history. There's something about it that's really sort of titillating to people.
But it's not sold as titillating, that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's sold as sort of...
Oh, it's kind of reading Playboy for the articles type thing.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And so in this, it's like, that one of the things that Ronson does acknowledge, I don't think enough in this, is that are people coming to this podcast because they're interested in mental health issues, which are on display but unexplored throughout? You know, are they interested in that? Are they interested in sadness? Are they interested in how an industry works? Or are they interested in, did the porn aspect hook them? Do you know what I mean?
Well,
these are all beautiful people who have...
It's sex and death, isn't it?
It's sex and death. And that's as you say, it's a story as old as time. We're always interested in it. It's not acknowledged enough in this.
And do you think, because it kind of gets a pass, because it's people with very fine liberal values, you know, John Ronson is a Guardian journalist originally, and therefore almost above or beyond reproach.
Yeah.
And therefore it's not accused of a sort of smuttiness, because the form itself is seen as somehow elevated. The idea of this American lifestyle podcast comes with a sort of cachet, doesn't it now?
Yeah, exactly. It's like we can go and look at and investigate anything because we're doing it for the right reasons.
Mm.
You might be, but that might not be why people are coming to listen to it.
And we just happen to have chosen porn again.
Well, exactly. And that's the other thing. The other thing is, you know, would there be so many listeners if it was about the car industry?
Or estate agents or
estate agents.
Actually,
it's
a really good podcast about the car industry. But anyway.
But also the separate point about the true crime thing is that, as you say, it's just... You have to be responsible about it. You have to be thorough. You have to be... If you're going to open up a case, which really means an awful lot to some people, couldn't be more important.
And in this, John Ronson's really, really sensitive about the people he's interviewing. So he's interviewing this guy, Kevin, who's a porn producer, whose young wife has killed herself. But then there are lots of allegations against him, and John Ronson's really careful about confronting this grieving man. But he's too careful, I think. There's not enough exploration.
But at least maybe, I mean, in his defence, he would say he's showing restraint and responsibility because he's a proper... He would say he's a responsible journalist doing it.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, what happens then is that all the people just get to present the masks with which they cope. And so then it all feels quite surface.
And there is still the question about why is this particular story being gone into in such depth and in so many ways. And the kind of horrible Twitter idea of the pylon goes throughout your piece, doesn't it? And how, tell us, can you in a seamless segue, how does that relate to the goddess Athena and the story of Arachne?
On the Mythology podcast, Vanessa Richardson presents, you know, great myths and stories. They're dramatized, the different actors come in and tell a bit, and then but what's actually quite interesting about it is they give this really good commentary and analysis of it. One of the episodes that I was listening to, they've taken the myth of Athena and Arachne when Athena and Arachne had this weaving competition, basically, because Arachne came along and said, I'm the best weaver in the world, but she's immortal. And Athena says...
Hence arachnid and spiders.
Yeah, Athena turns her into a spider.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah.
Well, not lovely for her.
No. So anyway, so Arachne sort of seemingly wins this competition, and Athena goes absolutely crazy. And the way it's described in this dramatisation is that she's not really just angry at Arachne for beating her. She's angry at everyone. So she's angry at Zeus, her father, for making her stand naked in front of a man, for conceiving her with just a thought and no mother. She's angry with herself for killing Pallas, who was her friend, for failing again and again to be the woman she wanted to be, even as she hit Arachne until every inch of her skin was red. So she goes mental. She really, as you say, piles on to Arachne. Arachne then kills herself. And Athena feels that it's very much her fault, because there's a direct thing. It's interesting that idea of a pylon with the idea of the Twitter pylon in the last days of August. It's interesting this idea that people doing it are angry, not really at the person they're attacking. They're angry they're angry at themselves. They're angry for lots of other things, and they're just using this one little moment where they can put pressure and make an impact.
So the channel's been opened and
lets out the rage.
Is this good though? I mean, how close is this to the any number of attempts to repopularize Greek myths in a sort of hackneyed way, which exists, you know, anytime someone wants to churn out a book, then let's retell the stories of the Greek myths.
Yeah. What's interesting about it actually, because when I start listening to it, it does sound a little bit made for schools or something. It does kind of hook you, because they're not actually trying to repopularize it. They're not trying to be I don't know, exciting or anything like that. They're just going, these are actually brilliant stories about why humans do what they do. And they're removed from the contemporary pain of individuals who are suffering, which is what you get in the last days of August. They're removed from all that, so we can actually look in a much bigger picture about why we feel as we feel, why we do as we do, why in this particular story, why Athena feels that there's a massive difference between who she was and who she wanted to be.
So it's worth it?
I think it's worth it, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You weren't very taken with the idea of it, were you?
Wait till we move on to the next one.
Yeah, the next one I'm not taken with
more.
At all. But no,
I'm up
for it. I just think it's interesting that it just seems easy to me to retell the Greek myths again.
It depends how you do it. If you bring something new and interesting to it, then I think that's fine.
Oh, shut up.
Also, a channel for Untapped Rage, Stig. Your final podcast that you talk about, Roz, is Goop.
Mm.
And I know that you thought long and hard before you wrote about this particular one. Why was that then? She asked innocently.
Because I didn't want to have to sit here and defend Goop.
What is
I
Goop?
I love
what
Goop. So Goop is...
Do you know what Goop is, Toby?
I know what Goop is.
Yeah. Goop, no, Toby knows what Goop is because Toby sits next to me in the office.
Does Roz talk about Goop a lot?
Enough.
More than enough.
I think even without Roz, I knew what Goop was.
Yeah. So it's a website originally conceived by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Mostly because it's taken the mick out of in the papers so much. I mean, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow is a bit of a figure of fun, isn't she?
Well, that's what... Yeah.
So it's what did you say? It's a website set up by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
It's a media empire worth $250 million.
Is it really $250 million now?
That she began.
Yeah.
With a laptop at her kitchen table.
So we should accord it more respect?
I mean, I think lots of people do now because it's making so much money. The problem is it's massively parodied.
But it also peddles snake oil to vulnerable people.
I don't think that's true, though.
Well, lots of scientists say it's
true.
Yeah,
it has said some pretty dodgy things in the past about health cares and things like that.
Yeah, the jade said, eggs.
The jade egg thing,
yeah.
I actually got this. So jade eggs, they still sell them. They were never...
These are these are vaginal jade eggs sold.
Yeah,
for,
but they made
but
claims
the thing is,
that were not true.
So the thing about jade eggs is you can get a plastic version off the NHS to strengthen your pelvic floor muscles, and they've been used for
it's not that. It's the fact that they said that they would do all sorts of other things.
They said that they would cultivate sexual energy and clear chi pathways in the body and intensify femininity and invigorate your life.
So that cannot be a fact.
That cannot be a verifiable claim. That's not a fact. That's fine.
Yeah.
But that's a...
I'm just interested because this week, because I was thinking, am I being... I think it's really worth exploring whether is cynicism attached because she's famous and rich and how much is it to do with she's a woman? I think there's legitimate questions. They've just done a deal, Goop, with Netflix to do a regular science show. And the coverage of it in mainstream media, mainstream liberal media, mm-hmm. the Daily Beast, The Guardian, things like that, is scientists across the board are saying we are deeply worried that Netflix are legitimizing what amounts to hippie musings into the realm of science. Now, this could be because scientists are annoyed that she's making lots of money in an mm-hmm. area which they previously were making lots of money. I concede that. But if you look at the coverage of Netflix, there's a deal with Gwyneth Paltrow to make a show. It's not how interesting that is. It's, oh my God, a snake oil salesman is being given yet another legitimised platform.
But surely you need to wait and see what the programme is.
That's a fair point.
I mean,
as
surely
well.
You can't. Perhaps you'll have lots of incredibly rigorous scientists on it.
Well, that would be relatively new development considering what has gone on.
That's not true, actually. So this is what we were talking about in the podcast. So I talk about the podcast in the group podcast of this piece because our very own Mary Beard appears in it and is talking about women.
She's Gwyneth Paltrow.
No, Gwyneth Paltrow rarely does the interviews. She has. She's called Elise Lonan.
Yep.
So Mary Beard appears on it and talks fantastically about Twitter trolls, about pylons, about, you know, lots of stuff that's in her Women and Power book. Mary Beard's not the only person with these credentials to appear on the Goop podcast, and often these people write on the site as well. Gwyneth Paltrow has access to all of the, like, these fantastic psychotherapists and relationship counsellors and nutritionists, and lots of them mostly very qualified people, and they
Has it matured in recent years then, do you think? I mean, the things that we used to ridicule about it, are they actually things from quite a long time ago, and since it's grown, has it?
Possibly. So I think, as we were talking yesterday, I think the net gain is good.
Yeah.
They produce a lot of content about how to make your life better without spending money, how to improve your relationships, how to improve your sense of self, they explore all of these ideas. They give it away for free.
But there is and I take that point, and you could argue that there's thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of content here of which a relatively small proportion might be
exactly.
controversial
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
There is a whiff of anti-science about all of this, and they sponsored last year a panel which is very heavily anti-vax.
Did they?
Right.
And there is a combination of believe certain mystical powers will help you and the anti-vax movement. And the anti-vaccination movement is one of the most threatening public health movements in the world. I'm not saying Gwyneth Paltrow espouses that or even people who write on the site in majority, but I think the nature of a site like this, pitched at a level which isn't always solely scientific, some of it is based on a sort of system of belief, some of it's based on a sort of holistic approach which carries with it things which are not necessarily fully scientifically underpinned, that can bring in a lot of fellow travellers who are anti-scientific or
There's a difference though, isn't there? Because as you say, if there's a lot of beneficial stuff about relationships and counsellors and all of that, and that's neither scientific nor unscientific, that's a wealth of experience and sort of practice which can be incredibly valuable, but that's not something you test in a lab anyway. But there's a world of difference, I think, between, I mean, you could totally believe all of that and still be completely on board with vaccinations.
You can't, but you can see
that's not the same. It's not.
But you can see how the two can bleed.
I'm surprised actually that they officially aligned themselves with anti-vaxxers, because that's a different.
And they would say that they officially they gave a platform and anti-vaxxers.
That's what they often say.
Expressed a belief.
Yeah, that's what they often say. I mean, I think a lot of the things that prove quite controversial come out of this kind of frustration. There are lots of female stories on Goop where they feel they've gone to a professional, to a doctor or something, and their concerns have been dismissed as female and as.
And is Gwyneth Paltrow getting it in the neck so much partially because she's a woman?
I would absolutely say yes to that. Yeah.
So there is a point here that it
they're like, we're going to try and find a different answer.
You can't find a different answer to vaccination.
And sure, you can't find a different answer to vaccination, but that I think they'd argue that this is, they're trying to explore just a different structure to answer some problems and to feel not being dismissed. I think all children should be vaccinated.
We're going to have to move on because we're going to talk to Toby while he's here about Arthur Miller.
Yes, we are. So we're going to silence Roz's woman's true voice.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry, Roz.
Enough of you, Roz.
Thank you very much. No, we're getting our money's worth.
Talk about jade eggs on the TLS podcast. Yeah, yeah.
Listen for the extended edition in which we talk about it for hours. Yeah. No, that's not true. Don't look for that. We're now going to get our money's worth out of Toby, who's coming back again because
he never left.
Didn't he? No. That's not my experience.
Apart from paternity.
Oh, he left the office. Yeah,
sorry, yeah. Roz is bitter because she's been doing the fiction pages.
I'd just like to say thank you very much to Roz for working overtime to make everything so brilliant over the past few months. So
come on, we're running out of time. Let's talk about Arthur Miller.
Toby has been talking about two new productions of Arthur Miller plays. So, Toby... why is it Arthur Miller time in London?
Good line, that I thought. That was a deliberate Miller time joke.
Yeah, Miller time. Very good. Ba-boom. It is Arthur Miller time because there are five separate productions of his plays, five different plays appearing over the next 5 months, which is, you know, it's peculiar. Is it just a coincidence? I don't know. They're not all at the same theatre. There are two at the Old Vic and one at the Young Vic. But they're not, you know, it's not a kind of coordinated season. Why more sort of generally, thematically? I guess he is... He's left-wing. We understand his politics. A lot of his worldview is shaped by his early years as a boy growing up during the Depression, which ruined his sort of middle-class comfort in his middle-class comforts. So a lot of his theatre deals with the kind of consequences of financial implosion, and 10 years on from the financial crisis that we're still dealing with, the political and social and familial problems caused by that. So his theatre, you know, has clear parallels to today. And there's also the kind of the influence of his experience as a McCarthyite witch being hunted. So his he's both anti-business, but he's also, you know, anti-big business, I should say, not small business, anti-big business, and kind of sceptical of capitalism, but he's also sceptical of state and the big state. And again, of course, that plays into contemporary
the intrusive
fears.
State.
And what it is to be American. I mean, that's the other thing. You read or watch Death of a Salesman, it kind of goes to the heart of Americanness.
Absolutely.
And that's a Trumpian...
Yeah,
notion.
Completely. And the idea of entrepreneurialism and the individual versus the state. I mean, you know, these are perennial themes, obviously, but today in particular, they seem to have a special resonance. And, you know, his big plays, Death of a Salesman, The Crucible, that, you know, they're studied in schools. They have been for 40 years. They're often revived. But it's actually notable that they're also, along with these, View from the Bridge is another one. There are two more minor productions, and these are the ones that I've reviewed. But they're the ones that are available to go and see now.
And watch. So it's The American Clock, which is on the Old Vic.
Yeah, which is the Young Vic. Sorry, the Old Vic.
And The Price, which is on at Wyndham's.
Yeah, and that was originally started in Bath, and so it's on a West End transfer now.
And it seemed to me that one of them you thought was perhaps lesser known for quite good reasons, and the other one not so much.
Yes,
is that right?
I would say that. So The American Clock, it first premiered on Broadway in the early 80s. It was a complete flop. I think only about 12 performances of it ran.
It's crazy considering how big.
Exactly, you know, this is the early 80s. Miller was a towering figure by then. They went through various versions, and then about 4 or 5 years later, there was a National Theatre version which incorporated lots of the previous elements, but this version had plenty of music and dance as well. And it wasn't brilliantly received. We reviewed it, Isabel Fonseca reviewed it for us, and she basically thought it was a bit of a disaster. There's a good line from her about how basically the singing and the dancing ruin the tension of the piece, I think she said. And I can see why she thought that, because this is a new production. It's just not a very good play. It's incredibly fragmented. I won't give you the whole praise of it, but it's about the Depression. It has 50 different characters. There's a central narrator. There's a central family, the Baum family, based loosely on Miller's own family, and it's about what happened to them during the Wall Street crash and in the sort of decade that followed. But there are millions of different things that go on. It's basically a series of vignettes. There's very little narrative that isn't purely chronological. I mean, you know, other than that one thing happens after another, we don't really have any sense of emotional development.
He was a great experimentalist, really, talks about what it is to be American.
Yeah,
theatrically,
absolutely.
He was
anti-avant-garde, but he was an experimentalist, and this is quite experimental, and it's just not a very good play. It's quite didactic. We don't really, you know, but I said in my piece, it's didactic, but the story we're told is familiar. It's, you know,
so
anyone who knows anything about the Depression will
come away from this knowing no more. So to me, the only reason I can see that it was staged was that it seems to play into such contemporary concerns about what happens to a culture and a political culture and a more sort of on the smaller scale of family culture when we lose belief in the system, in the financial system, and you know, sort of the decade that follows. But it's just it's not a good play, and it's not done well, I must say. So much effort has gone into this production. The acting's pretty good. The sort of the music and dance are good, but the way it's been handled, it's been triple cast. So the Baum family, instead of just one set of players playing it, it's been triple cast, so that it evolves from being a Jewish family into a South Asian family, and then finally into an African American family. And you can see why they've done this, because they're an everyman family, and so it makes it much more representative. But it's confusing enough without them doing that, and it just doesn't work.
How about the price?
Better.
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Much better. It's not a flawless play by any means, but it's a much smaller one. Very little happens. Again, I won't give you a long précis, but it's basically about these two brothers and the inheritance from their father and what happened to him. The father basically, again, he was a bit like Arthur Miller's father. He was broken by the Depression. One brother stays at home and looks after him. The other goes off and is successful, and it's about the tension between the two brothers. And then you've got this other character, Solomon, who's played by David Suchet, who's brilliant in it. And he's this kind of sort of aging, elderly, actually 89-year-old, Jewish, sort of Yiddish-inflected furniture dealer. And he's there to kind of deal with the estate, and he brings a lot of humour, but he also breaks up the tension between the two brothers and is a kind of interesting counterpoint. The problem with this play is he's the heart of it, and he disappears for most of the second act, and there's not much you can do with that as a director.
And just to tie it back to the beginning, I suppose, Toby, he's funny because he's Yiddish, and
well,
he's Yiddish because he's funny.
A bit, yeah. So I sort of say in the piece, just as an aside, why is Yiddish, and especially stage Yiddish and Yiddish inflection, inherently comic? Or seems inherently comic? What is it about it? I reviewed earlier last year the Lehman trilogy, quite a long play about.
Yeah, with Lucy, I think.
Yeah, and it was about, you know, that was about
that was about
150
about
years of financial fallout, and there was quite a bit of Yiddish in it. And every time someone said something slightly back to front in a Yiddish way, everyone laughed.
They were the sort of funny, charming bits.
They were the funny, charming bits. And what is it about that?
Well, I suppose the problem is not that it's funny and charming, but if that's all it is,
if you can't
say anything serious or tragic or difficult or challenging with that kind of inflection, why is it only seen as a kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and particularly these days when Yiddish is actually the spoken language is massively on the rise. I think, you know, I think we probably need to rethink our understanding of Yiddish.
Well, that might be the subject of another piece in another podcast.
Perhaps.
Yep.
That's all we've got time for. We've crammed too much in. Thanks to Roz Dadid and Toby Lichtig. We should probably thank Thea for bothering to answer her phone. Thanks,
Alf, as well.
Thank you, Alf, if he exists.
It's a good way of getting a week off work,
isn't it?
I'm sure that's not what she did.
I might try that.
I'm going to get a dog. I'm only coming back at the end of this week. So it's time to get a dog. God. I've had a child. Yeah. Now let's have a dog.
Let's have a dog. Next week, then, Thea is supposed to be working from work. So we'll see if she's here. We'll be talking flamboyantly in and about French. So I particularly look forward to that. You could do it better than me, Lucy.
No, I'm sure I couldn't, but I'll be sorry not to be here.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Maybe Thea won't be back.
I'm sure she will.
Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.